Accession number 4608, reel number 3.
Air Marshal Sir Victor Groom, Reel 3. You were telling me about the time that you were ill in Asia Minor.
Well, I was put into this ambulance, and I've already said it was a very bad journey. And by the time we arrived at the military hospital at Finaraki, I was completely out. I learnt from another fellow member of the squadron who was already in the hospital, a chap named Hindu Jones, that I was wheeled into the ward, and he thought I was dead, and I didn't come round for 3 days. I gather they were pumping something into me. I can't remember what it was, but I had malignant malaria, and I really nearly did die. Eventually I did come to. And then I was transferred from the military hospital in Finaraki into a better hospital in Constantinople itself. And there I had the opportunity of going out and wandering around, and I found it a fascinating place. Of course, the usual places like Saint Sophie and those sort of things, but apart from that, just wandering around, looking into completely strange sort of place to me, who've never travelled anywhere except what I've told you already about, and to see such an ancient city, quite different from anything else I'd ever experienced, was really quite magnificent. Of course, it was very heavily occupied. It was the headquarters of the British Army in Turkey at the time, in fact, for the whole of the Levant. And a very large military force was in obvious. It was obvious that not only British, of course, the French were there as well. I never really discovered why we would been sent to Turkey. Of course, it was the time when Kemal Atatürk first came into power, if my memory serves me right. And I presume that we hadn't recognized him, and I presume our British forces in Asia Minor were lined up against him. In the short time I was there in the squadron in Asia Minor, of course, I never saw any enemy. I certainly never took part in any raids against anybody, but I did learn from the squadron afterwards that they were involved in some operations of some sort against somebody, but whom I haven't the foggiest idea. Anyway, I enjoyed myself in Constantinople. And it was when somebody from the squadron was visiting me that I learnt the squadron was under orders to move. Now, the last thing I wanted to be was left alone in Asia Minor. With the squadron going off, I was determined to get back to the squadron if I could. I may say that my experiences as an armoured officer in the squadron had changed a bit by the time we got to Asia Minor, because they posted a full-time, fully qualified ex-RNAS warrant officer, who was then a 138er and had been commissioned in the Air Force, as a pucker armament officer.
What's a 138er?
Well, a 138er was... 138 was an Air Ministry order published in 1918 when the Air Force was formed, which commissioned naval warrant officers who were neither one thing nor the other in the RNAS. And, of course, in the Air Force, a warrant officer was quite different from a warrant officer in the Navy. And so these chaps had to be commissioned. And they were ever afterwards known as 138ers, because that was the Air Ministry order which distinguished them and gave them their officer status. They weren't regarded as ordinary officers. They were 138ers, as far as we were concerned. But they were all technical chaps, every one of them. The ordinary flying officers, who were proper officers in the Navy, they came over in the same way that we did from the Flying Corps. Anyway, this chap, Wire, came as a full-time armament officer, and I may say that he taught me a lot in the few days I was still with the squadron, and I was allowed to see what he did in the armament field. I learnt how to solder and weld and do all sorts of things from him. He was most instructive. Anyway, I learnt the squadron was going to move. And I didn't want to get out of this, so I went to see the CO of the hospital and explained that the squadron was embarking on a certain date, and please could I go with it? And he said, well, the sea voyage will obviously do you good. And so I was allowed to pack up my kit, and I arrived on the quay at Fenerake. Of course, one had to go across in the ferry boats in those days. And I don't know how I got there with my kit and everything, but there I was when the squadron was embarking, and I embarked with them. Now, the squadron and the aircraft park were both being embarked into this one ship. It was HMS Ark Royal. Now, I don't have any ideas that this was the lovely aircraft carrier that we know about in these days. The Ark Royal was really like a very small tanker, without any tanks in it, but with an enormous well. It had the engine and the bridge aft, and such sleeping accommodation as there was. In front of this, there was a deck with a hangar built over it, and then in front of that was this enormous well into which the seaplanes, for which it was a seaplane tender really, were lowered into the well of this ship and then lifted out for maintenance onto the deck into this hangar. Well, now, the RNAS squadron, or whatever it was that had used this with the seaplanes, was very small. And here we were, an aircraft park and a squadron with all its aeroplanes being loaded into this. Now, I can't tell you a great deal about what happened and why we were going off in this journey, but the CO of the squadron leader Nicholas, when he was at the Staff College, gave a lecture on the move of 55 Squadron to Iraq. It was unique at the time and formed, I'm told, the basis for a good many moves of squadrons in this way later on. But he wrote his lecture off, and I know all about this because he came to Farnborough, where I was stationed at the time, in about 1923 or 24. To consult me about various points about the squadron move when he was writing his lecture. But I know there was a written copy of the lecture in the annals of the Staff College at Camberley, and they know all about it. Anyway, we were put into this ship. Now, I do remember this. The wings had been taken off the aeroplanes, DH-9As then, of course, I think. I don't think we had any 9s with us at the time we embarked. I know we took some 9s up with us to Turkey, but how many I can't remember. But the wings were taken off the aeroplanes, and first of all, the cases, the aeroplane cases, with the wings inside were lowered into the hold. The aeroplane then, less wings, still with its undercarriage and its engine in, was then lowered onto the top of each engine aeroplane case and lashed down. And that's how they travelled from Fenerake back through the Suez Canal, down the Persian Gulf, and on round to Basra.
What happened to the seaplanes that the Ark Royal?
We left those in Fenerake. Those were left behind on the quay, as far as I remember. My memory is a bit hazy about this. After all, I'd just come out of hospital, and I had nothing to do with the move of the squadron. I just arrived with my baggage and was fortunately taken aboard. There was some discussion when we got back to, when we were in Ismailia on our way through the Suez Canal, whether I was going to be allowed to stay with the squadron. However, I did go on round in the Ark Royal.
What were the conditions like during the journey?
They were absolutely appalling. The troops and the officers, well, A lot of the officers were sleeping in the boats up on deck because there wasn't enough cabin space, and anyway, it was terribly hot. The top speed of the Ark Royal, my memory serves me right, was 8 knots. We had a following wind down the Red Sea. I think we had 2 airmen die of heat stroke. Many of us suffered from rashes round the tummy with heat stroke and so on. And Aden, which has a reputation for being a very hot place, was absolute heaven to us, arriving there as we did in September 1920. September, yes. This was in September 1920. It was an appalling journey. It was during this period that Wing Commander Fellows, who was commanding Q Force, gave us a lecture about the squadron and the aircraft park. And one of the terms he used at that time, we were all sitting on deck when he was giving us this lecture, was that the squadron was the spear point of the force, and that the aircraft park was only the supply organization to back us up. But the important part was the squadron. I mention this now because later on, the spear point was adopted as the squadron crest, and indeed it's to be visible now, it still is the squadron crest of the squadron. But it wasn't adopted till later on. Anyway, we arrived in Aden, and then on we went round the Crucial Coast and up to this very important part that is so much in the news now, with the fears about Russians getting down into Iran oil. And then up we went to Basra and anchored there, and tenders came alongside, and the spare parts and everything were hoisted out of the aeroplane down into the tenders and ferried ashore, not to Basra, but across to a place called Tanuma, which was on the east side of the Gulf, not far from Basra. And we went into the sort of transit camp while the aeroplanes, still on their wheels, without any wings on, were towed along the road up to the landing ground. And the aeroplane cases were put on lorries and taken off to the airfield, where the airmen then started to assemble the aeroplanes. Now, this was about the 23rd of September, and my first night ashore in this transit camp, very, very hot. We didn't have any mosquito nets, and we slept under big fans which slowly revolved and kept away the sandflies and mosquitoes. But unfortunately, that night there was a power failure and the fans stopped, and I was very badly bitten. And the next day, I suppose really I was very vulnerable to all this business, having only just got over malaria. In fact, I hadn't got over malaria. It stayed with me for about 10 years afterwards, and I used to get recurrences of it. But I ran a very heavy, high temperature again. And before I knew where I was, the next day I was being taken down the river to a military hospital a little way down the Gulf, a little way down below Basra. Can't remember the name of the place now. I'd got sandfly fever, which in many ways, while it lasts, is much worse than malaria. But of course it doesn't really last very long, but it's terrible when you do. You run terribly high temperatures. And I was again shoveled out of a boat into a hospital, more dead than alive. Can't remember how long I was there, but I know it was long enough for the squadron to have erected its aeroplanes and flown them up to Baghdad.
What was the hospital like?
Oh, the hospital was a great improvement on anything in Turkey. And the British sisters, of course, and everything was very clean. I don't think it was tents. I think it must have been a building of some sort, and my recollection is very hazy on this. But I know I was very happy there and made very comfortable indeed. I can't remember what the name of the place was now. I did know, but I can't remember. My memory is so bad. Stop it.
So you moved from the hut of camp at Tanuma to the hospital at south of Basra.
Yes, it was called Bet Nama. And it was such a relief after the conditions under which I'd been living. It must have been an old Turkish house. And I remember everything was so clean and I was able to have a decent bath. I must have been absolutely filthy when I arrived there. And it was so nice to be in a proper bed with sheets and everything else after the conditions under which one had been living and travelling. And the hospital was far, far better than the hospitals in Turkey. Of course, it was far removed from a war, and after all, September 1920, I suppose they'd had time to get things in order. I was in the hospital there for 3 weeks, and meantime the squadron directed its aeroplanes and flown off to Baghdad. Now, I should explain that at this time there was what was called the insurrection in Iraq. The Arabs had risen against the occupying forces. The British were cut off in various areas. The area around Basra was encircled by the Arabs, and there was nothing in the way of a military force between there and Kut El Amara, which was a long way up country. There was an airfield at Basra called Shaiba, and was of course used by the Air Force for many, many years afterwards. There was a squadron there. I can't remember now, my recollection is bad, but I think it was 48 squadron, but I can't be sure. I didn't go out there to see it, but when I was discharged from the hospital, my only means of getting up to rejoin the squadron at Baghdad was to go by boat. The railways, of course, were all cut. And indeed, the Manchester Regiment, which had been travelling up from Basra to Baghdad, had been ambushed at one time or another on the railway between Basra and Baghdad, and decimated. Now, whether that happened before I went up by paddle steamer or afterwards, I don't know, but the only main supply route to Kut was by paddle steamer. Now, this was all part of the inland, what was called inland water transport. They were stern paddle wheelers. I think most of them had been bought from India. And indeed, the whole of the forces in Iraq at that time were virtually under the government of India. And the country was occupied by a very large number of Indian Army regiments. And most of the political agents in the different parts of occupied territory in Mesopotamia were Indian Army, not Indian Army, Indian Political Service people. The district officers, as I came to know them later on, were all drawn from the Indian Political Service. Anyway, there we were, travelling in a paddle steamer up the Euphrates, or was it the Tigris? As you know, they joined together at Basra, and I ought to know one from the other by this time. I think I went up the Tigris to Kut. And there was a general, Richardson, on board at the time, and nobody else. Alongside this paddle, along the decks of the paddle steamer, sandbags were built up chest high. Because it was a favorite trick of the Arabs to take pot shots at the paddle steamers as they were going up. It was most interesting. The river winds terribly, and you would see dotted about across the landscape, very flat, of course, everything's very flat. You could see the smoke from steamers going in opposite directions all around you because of the way the river was continually winding like this as we went along. I can't remember how many days I spent aboard the Peril steamer. We were shot at periodically, but I quite enjoyed the journey. We periodically ran aground. Up in the bows of the boat, there was an Arab or an Indian, I can't remember which, with a long pole, who would sing out what the depth of the water was as he stuck the pole down into the sand. Art foot, he would call out, or bolt pani, so he must have been an Indian, speaking Hindustani. And then the next thing, of course, you hit a sandbank, and sometimes it was quite difficult to get off. However, we eventually arrived at Kutel Amara.
When you were fired at, did the shots come close, or
were hiding down behind the sandbags, so I never looked over the top to see. I'm not that brave, and I was quite happy to lie down on a chair or something behind the sandbags most of the time and to avoid it. One never knew when you were going to be shot at. You just heard of bullets, and that was it, and so it kept on. And it was only the Arabs having their fun, taking pot shots at things, good Lord, as I discovered later on. They were very fond of that sort of thing. However, we arrived at Kutel Amara. Now, at that time, the Air Force airfield at Baghdad was at what was called Baghdad West. It was, again, only a stretch of desert, flat ground, somewhere west of Baghdad. That's all I can tell you. On it was my squadron, 55 squadron, newly arrived. There was 30 squadron, also equipped with DH-9As, and 6 squadron, which was equipped with Bristol fighters. Now, I can't remember. Yes, I went by train from Kutel Amara to Baghdad, and then I was met there by a tender, which drove me out to Baghdad West.
Had the airfield at Hanaidi been built at this time?
No. They were only at that stage surveying Hanaidi. Hanaidi was not built during the time I was in Baghdad, during the time I was in Iraq. I can't remember when it was opened, but it certainly wasn't opened in my time. Baghdad West was in use. Now, Baghdad West, as I say, had 3 squadrons. We were all in tents, and Baghdad in the winter time can be very, very cold indeed. Not as cold as it was at Mosul, where I went afterwards, but it was very cold, and we had EP tents. Again, the officers had EP tents and paraffin stoves to try and keep us warm.
Can you describe an EP tent for me?
The EP tent is a double. It's 2 tents, really. It's one inside another one, so you've got a double skin, so that in the you get an air layer between the 2 skins of tent, more for the heat point of view, not from the cold, so that it does alleviate the tremendous heat. In an ordinary tent, with the sun burning down in the hot weather, as it does in Iraq or Egypt, or in those places in the summertime, it's quite impossible. You couldn't sleep in it. You have to have these double tents. An EP-IP tent is European pattern, Indian pattern. I think that's what it meant and stood for. But an EP tent is a large tent. It's not a bell tent. It's square. And you could divide it up with partitions so that you could have seclusion for more than one officer in it if you wanted to. Or often we had one EP tent to ourselves, and you made half of it your sitting room and half your sleeping quarters. They're quite comfortable. But of course, eternal dust. When you're out in the desert like that, everything is dusty. The only time it's not dusty is when in the spring you've got a little rain, and then overnight everything would turn green. But it didn't stay green very long. Anyway, I arrived at Baghdad.
How many other squadrons were there in Iraq at this time, besides the 3 in Baghdad? And
we had 3 flights of 4 airplanes each. I can't remember how many airmen there were in the squadron. I managed to get later on, for my own information, a list of the officers who were in the squadron at that time. This was dropped for me by a friend of mine who was in control of the Air Force Benevolent Fund, and he had an Air Force list of April 1921. And we had quite a lot of officers in the squadron that time. The squadron leader commanding, three flight lieutenants who commanded the flights, and 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, and 26 officers. But, and in addition, a medical officer, this chap Canton, that I told you about.
How many of those officers would be flying officers, or officers involved in flying duties?
Four of those officers didn't fly.
Four didn't fly?
Yes. They were an armoured officer, one of the 138ers, another 138er, who was the signals officer, a chap named Allen, who was the equipment officer, he wasn't a 138er, and there was one other chap, I don't know what the devil he did, Lochner, he didn't fly, and I don't know what he did at that time, but the rest of us were all flying. So I suppose it meant there were about four or five officers, five, including the flight commander in each flight, you see. That may have been six.
Did you have your own individual aircraft?
Oh, yes. You had your own individual aircraft, and in each flight, the aircraft were lettered, and according to the flight, and numbered. And I flew what was known as always, for convenience, B4. Now, the aeroplanes had their own numbers on as well, of course, but you never referred to them by the number, the serial number on the tail of the aeroplane, except officially in the logbooks, of course, and one recorded it in one's own logbook. But from flight orders point of view, or anything of that sort, you always talked about B1 or B2 or B4. I have a note which the historian of 55 Squadron gave me, made up by an airman named Osterman, who was with me in the flight at the time, and he made some notes of various things that went on, some of which I don't think were entirely accurate, but he always referred to Maxwell flying B1 or Groom in B4 or Sylvester in B3 or something of that sort, because it was a much more convenient way than talking about DH9A7834 or something of sort, you see.
Did you have your own individual air crew to look after that particular plane?
Well, of course, there were nothing but pilots in those days, and the chaps, as they were two-seaters, if you flew with anybody, you flew either your rigger or your fitter. And my rigger at that time was a man named Hughes, and my fitter was this chap Osterman that I was talking about, who made these notes for the historian of 55 Squadron. Looking through my logbook, I see that in the main, Hughes flew with me more than anybody else. When we were in Baghdad, of course, I didn't arrive in the squadron until about the end of October, I suppose, and of course it's beginning to come warm, wintry time then, and we were doing reconnaissances. I've told you Baghdad was virtually besieged. Well, the area stretched down as far as Kut, and there were a lot of troops there, but the whole of Iraq between there and Basra was cut off. And I suppose they must have tried to run trains periodically, because in November 1920, I went with Maxwell, who was my flight commander, to do a reconnaissance of the railway between Baghdad and Basra. Now, this is why I said earlier on, I'm not sure whether it was during that period that the Manchester Regiment was ambushed. But anyway, the railway was always being cut. And we, obviously, the officers who were pilots, were trained to do reconnaissance things, whereas the airmen were the fitters and the riggers who flew as our passengers in the back seat, virtually only as passengers, weren't trained to do reconnaissance. So if a reconnaissance had to be made, one of the other pilots went with the flight commander or with another officer to do it. And I was detailed, or went. I was also the intelligence officer of the squadron at this time, for some unknown reason. And I went with Maxwell to fly down to do a reconnaissance. Now, there was an outpost at a place called Hiller. I can't remember how far it was down south of Baghdad, but it was on the Euphrates, and this was a small camp where there was a detachment of the army. I can't tell you how much, but there was also a small airfield within the perimeter. And 6th Squadron, with its Bristol fighters, had a detachment there. And we passed over this on our way down from Baghdad, down following the railway down. We passed over Hillah. This was done at very early morning. And we went on following the railway. I remember we crossed the Euphrates, and I was flying in the back seat, of course. And it wasn't long afterwards that I felt water coming into me in the back cockpit. Well, there was only one place the water could be coming from, and that was the engine. And it was quite obvious because the temperature gauge on the dashboard suddenly shot round to boiling point, and the engine seized up.